If you're just joining us, this podcast is serialized, so it is best enjoy listening to episodes in order. Go back, start at the beginning, we'll be right here. Also, as a caution, there are some graphic scenes in this episode. In the corners of Angola, legend and reality are one and the same. There are things that you can't see, like Mukisi. This is the dragon creature who lives in the highland lakes. Story has it, if you look at it, you die. But then, there are tales of things that walk among us.
We must find the ghost elephants of Lesima. We can find their dung, we can find their tracks, we can find their trails, but we can't find them.
You might remember Steve from the first episode of this series. He is the intrepid South African zoologist who now runs the National Geographic Okavango Wilderness Project. When Steve says the ghost elephants of Lesima, he's referencing a Lushaa's expression.
Lesima Liamawana, the source of life.
Lesima is now the name of the project's study area. Steve's quest to find the ghost elephants of Lesima is what hooked our producer, Kat Jaffe. Kat was awarded a National Geographic Storytelling Grant to help us make this show.
The first time I really spoke to Steve about the details of what we would be doing together in Angola was just days before jumping on the expedition. I had known for months that I would be joining them in the field, but I didn't know what the story was or what we'd be doing. For the call, I was sitting in a coffee shop in my home in Colorado. We were talking on WhatsApp, and I asked Steve, "What do you think the story's going to be?" And he tells me, "We're searching for ghost elephants." And I figured, well, that's a good enough pitch to get me on a plane. Right after I got off the call, I Googled ghost elephants, but the search results didn't make sense. I found a poem in The New Yorker about loss. Ghost Elephants by Jean Valentin, August 27th, 2007. In the elephant field, tall green ghost
There was
elephants.
An article about a clown cemetery in Illinois that also popped up.
In nearby towns, a persistent schoolyard legend has it that those stone elephants mark the graves of the
And then
elephants.
There are these elephants in Namibia that cover themselves in mud to stay cool. Nothing connected to Angola. So it seemed like the term ghost elephant was not a recognized scientific thing. It was something else. And after 4 months in the region, it wasn't until my last few days that I really figured out what that something else was. It was one of the few daylight hours in February without rain. The sun made everything sticky and hot. We were back in Chinjanga, a village Curlin, Steve, and I visited together in November 2019. The last time we were here, Curlin told me that a week prior, a lion had killed a family of pigs a few steps from where I had set up my tent. Despite what people may think about animals in Africa, it's actually rather unusual for them to roam so freely, not in any kind of park, which is why this time we were asking the local villagers about another animal sighting.
Okay, we can move on to discussion about the elephants. We see them as we travel down the river. We'll see signs of them as we travel down the rivers, simply to know when they come up and where they go. At, you know, this time of year, or in April and May, how long would it take someone to find an elephant?
When we speak with local village communities, Curlin translates English to Portuguese and then works with a local named Ifaf, who explains details in Chokwe and Luchas. For hours, each of us stare, wait, and wonder. And every time a full sentence is translated, the thought is acknowledged with clapping and nods. Back and forth, Steve surveys the villagers' lives and their families and their needs. And then, at the very end of their conversation, he asks, "Where are the elephants?" That's because the villagers are the only ones who have answers.
Okay, where are the elephants?
Nicola.
Asi.
Mihuma. Mikolo.
Makolo.
Inya yu akawala kune miiga.
Tongo.
Tongo. Yemi tondo akawala kune yema.
They say at this time of the year they're probably at really, really soft. Earlier they were just mentioning the different types of trees and leaves that they search for.
Okay, that's helpful.
Chinjanga is a village of about 20 houses in an otherwise uninterrupted vast stretch of Miombo forest that is teeming with wildlife. Termites after it rains, sweat bees when it's hot, hungry ants that bite our feet and form lines across the red sand in the night. This is a place where big and small roam freely, and the prize species, if you believe that they still frequent this area, are the elephants. While international communities have an obsession with elephants, this is particularly the case in Angola. And if Steve can confirm that they're here, it means big things for this project, like money and support and attention.
And that's because elephants in Angola have a painful story. A story that has transformed them into mere ghosts, haunting the landscape, but rarely seen. And their backstory helps us understand everything. Can tracking the largest land mammal in eastern Angola ensure that the whole of the Okavango Delta region is protected? What will it take for a place, its land, its people, its elephants, to heal from decades of trauma? And how necessary is healing prior to rolling out an ambitious conservation agenda? You're listening to Guardians of the River. I'm your host, Carolyn Costa, and we're a podcast exploring how to protect some of the most remote and wild places on the planet, starting with the Okavango Delta and the Source Lakes. This is Chapter 2, Ghost Elephants of Lisimo. The legend of Steve's ghost elephant starts with one particularly famous Angolan.
Henry just towers over you. He is on an elevated stand, almost as like on an altar. I think his feet are probably at about the height of an adult.
This is Cheryl Bronstein. Cheryl was the head of exhibition development and planning at the Smithsonian National Zoo in Washington, D.C.
I remember going into the Natural History Museum pretty much on my first day starting at the Smithsonian. I just signed all my paperwork and then I went across the mall to the Natural History Museum and there was Henry. He is an African elephant. I think it's one of those iconic aspects of pride. I can't believe I'm working at an institution that has something like this. And I feel that an awful lot of people at the Smithsonian do have this kind of strange love affair with Henry.
Strange because Henry has a painful history. Henry is also known as the Fenikovi elephant, after Joseph J. Fenikovi, the man who set out to hunt Henry in 1955.
Throughout this project, I've heard the story of the Fenikovi elephant many, many times.
Our producer, Kat Shafi, again.
And it goes like this. Fenikovi, who was a Hungarian businessman, owned a 1,000-acre game farm in southeastern Angola, which he would visit on holiday. One day, in 1954, Fenikovi was strolling by a lake and he spotted an enormous elephant footprint in the mud. Another word for footprint apparently is spoor, which I think is interesting. Anyways, Fenikovi knew the biggest elephant on record at that time had a spoor that was 2 feet long, which made the footprint before him, measuring a whole 3 feet, almost a meter in length, one of an unparalleled giant.
This is elephant country.
Fenikovi tried to follow these tracks, but with no luck. However, he knew that elephants are creatures of habit, So a year later, he returned with a 416 Rigby rifle and found the same large tracks by the same lake.
The hunters are coming in from downwind very, very quietly.
He followed them again, which led him to two elephants, one being the giant of his dreams.
That's the one they want, that big tusker.
Fenikovi chased the larger elephant and, with his hunting party, fired 11 bullets.
He's hit! They got him again! The bull is badly hurt, but he may need a finishing shot, and they'll have to go into the bush after him.
He couldn't bring it down, so he ordered his aide to go after the elephant with 5 more shots, which finally killed it.
In the weeks that followed, they embalmed the body in salt and hauled it 600 miles through the bush to the closest railway station. Joseph Fenikovi's goal was to hunt and kill the largest living land animal in the world at that time, and then put it in a museum. He asked the Smithsonian if they would be interested in displaying this elephant, and they accepted.
Which meant, in 1959, the elephant was installed at the entrance to the museum, where it still stands today.
That was a time when, obviously, conservation was coming into more and more of the national dialogue, but also the notion that conservation was related to the taking of animals. So a lot of parks and preserves were created to maintain populations of animals for hunters. And the hunters were the big champions of some of this land preservation. And I don't think that we can really separate those two, the hunter and the conservationist.
One thing that really sticks with me from the story is, what about the other elephant, the smaller one that was there next to Fenikovi's target? It saw the killing, and I'm guessing it lived. Steve tells me that elephant herds have distinct cultures, survival tricks, and wisdom that they pass to one another. He says they experience grief, trauma, and loss. Apparently, they even stand around the bodies of their dead, stroking each other's trunks in what some call elephant funerals. After seeing what it saw, where did this surviving elephant go?
If you're thinking about the distress that one elephant experienced, the following decades in Angola may be some of the most traumatic in human elephant history. Enough trauma to affect not only Henry's surviving witness, but to force a whole population of elephants into hiding. In 1961, just 5 years after the Fenikovi elephant was shot, Angola began their fight for freedom from 400 years of Portuguese rule. It was called the Angolan War of Independence, which marked the beginning of 40 years of conflict.
Elephants most certainly were mortared, shot at with AK-47s. The older ones will carry wounds from those times and memories, the memory of the war and the trauma that they experienced, their families being broken up and targeted. They are sentient beings. Same as we would remember, they will.
Right as colonial rule was ending, a new war was well underway. In 1975, the Cold War set its sights on the independent Angola as an ideal battleground to fight the spread of communism. China, Cuba, the US, and South Africa all wanted to control who would be the next leader of Angola. Having been born into the Angolan Civil War, it feels like it's been going on for a big part of my life. Even today, when I drive through most rural towns, I still see crumbling buildings from bullets and explosions. The war continued on and on because the international community enabled it.
I think it's important for people in the U.S. to know this, because this was a war we supported and contributed to. The biggest opposition leader, Jonas Savimbi, flew around the world to raise money, including 4 visits to the United States. In one instance, he even had a fundraising dinner with former President George H.W. Bush. And what couldn't be funded by international powers came from what Angola still had a lot of at the time: diamonds and ivory.
This very notion of ivory is something that can only come out of death. An elephant must die in order for an ivory object to be created.
Elephants were used as target practice, and their ivory was sold off to buy more weapons. If the elephants weren't being shot at, they walked in fear of landmines in the ground beneath them, exploding without warning. During this conflict, Angola became one of the most heavily mined countries on Earth.
Elephants have a stronger sense of smell than a bloodhound, hundreds of thousands of sensors in their trunk. So they can smell arms caches, AK-47s, bullets, military personnel and vehicles many, many kilometers away.
So elephants, like humans, became casualties of war. During the war, and the time since its end, the elephant population dropped from 50,000 to 4,000 elephants. That's like saying out of every 10 elephants, only one survived. The existing elephant population remains elusive. Even acquiring this statistic to share with you took weeks of research and cross-referencing.
The ghost elephants of Lesima are traumatized by decades of war.
This is what Steve means when he says ghost elephants. He's talking about the walking dead, elephants that have seen some of the most horrific violence against their kind and still live to tell the story.
They are hiding from us. We have gone out there and put camera traps on the trails that we know of, and they have turned those cameras over. We still do not have a photograph of a ghost elephant.
The notion that these animals were something to be conquered, to be destroyed, that you proved your prowess, was really prevalent in the age of the big game hunter. So I think that we as a culture today have almost globally had a fundamental shift in how we think about elephants. You think about Babar, you think about Horton, and these are incredibly sympathetic characters that kids can relate to and have tremendous empathy for. And so we no longer think of these animals as something that we do want to destroy, but rather much more as, you know, a poster child, as much as a panda is for conservation. Elephants are right there with them. I think that it's just a phenomenal transformation of the human psyche.
It is a phenomenal transformation in places where people don't actually live with elephants. But life on the ground with them is quite different.
And the elephant, he pulled the vehicle away. He just pushed them away. When I woke up, I was between the legs of elephants. And I didn't count it, but it was looks like 20 of them.
This is Water. He is a YA polar and guide from Botswana who works with Steve on each expedition. You met him in Chapter 1. He's describing this one time when he took three private guests into the Moremi Reserve, a protected area in the middle of the Delta. They were driving in an open vehicle. It was early evening. The guests spotted a group of 20 savanna elephants. They asked Water to go closer. Water drove near the herd and then saw something that made him turn off the motor at once.
Inside was a tiny, tiny baby. It looks like between 1 to 2 weeks.
A little baby meant that the other elephants would be very protective, and Water didn't want to draw attention to himself. He was eyeing the herd when, from the other side of the car, an elephant charged the vehicle.
And then I was running away. I didn't run back to the vehicle because I was trying to save my guest from the elephant.
Water ran behind a termite mound, then a tree. He hid, and then ran, and hid. Then ran. But the elephant was smart, angry, and wouldn't be fooled.
And then I heard the elephant shouting. And then he hit me with the trunk. I fall to my back. And then the elephant, he kneeled down close to me. And the tusky went through my jacket. And then he tried to open my stomach. And then the tusk went between my underpants with my trouser. It didn't break the bones, just skin. And then I was sleeping like I'm dead. Because when you move, they know you're still alive, they come to finish you. And then I feel like no one on top of me. I was very lucky. And then I'm still scared to open my eye. I'm thinking maybe the elephant is still there, but he was already gone.
One of the guests picked up Water, who was crying, holding his side, and shifting in and out of consciousness. Water's stomach was sliced open, down to his waist. When they finally made it back to camp and Water recovered, he told his boss he didn't want to guide anymore. Beyond the gashes across his body, Water was rattled. For people like Water, elephant attacks are simply an occupational hazard.
This fence is like this for the elephants.
What does it look like?
It's a regular fence, but then it's got electric pincers, I suppose, sticking out to shock the ellies if they come close.
I'm sitting on the passenger side of one of the project's land cruisers while Koketsu Mukodi, or Koki, drives us through the Delta. Koki is the Botswana country director for the National Geographic Okavango Wilderness Project, the NGOWP. Koki is short and tough. She whips the land cruiser around sandy drainages like it's a newly paved neighborhood. Smells of maguinya, translated as fat cake, coat the insides of our car. It's basically a fried dough that looks like a donut without a hole. We have a dozen of them with us to bring to the people in the Delta.
What does it look like right now?
Right now, thankfully, because of the rain, there's nice short green grass, which makes it more very attractive. So it takes away from the depression of the recent dryness that we've experienced.
Right now is known as the wet season, meaning it's supposed to be raining here, but it hasn't.
But is there any water in the river?
There is absolutely nothing in the river, except for dead animals.
Beds are dry, and there's still not enough water or food for the animals in the Delta.
There are a lot of cows grazing the landscape. And then there's also been like a lot of dead cows. Oh, like there's one right there.
There are more than one dead cow. Let's drive over and see. Okay, there's three carcasses currently.
We've got a problem of human-wildlife conflict. We are holding the burden for many of the other regions in terms of elephant populations. Our landscapes are changing.
This is a totally different type of human-wildlife conflict than in Angola. If elephants in Angola are ghosts, elephants in Botswana might feel a bit like gangs. Over the last 9 years, Koki has watched Botswana's elephant population grow and grow. Because while Angola was recovering from war, Botswana made the killing and hunting of elephants a criminal offense. Yes, this was to protect the elephants, but also to grow tourism, which makes up 12% of Botswana's economy.
Mind you, when the ban was put in place, there was no consultation in the areas that were highly affected all throughout the country. Populations of elephants rose, and the destruction on local villages was very evident. But because, you know, we had a leadership that was hell-bent on protecting wildlife, the voices of the people fell on deaf ears. Collectively, the communities of the country decided, you know, we need to bring back a system that has worked before, that has benefited certain communities before. And so whether I personally agree with it or not is not the matter. The matter is that the people who are most affected by it should have a voice in how they want to manage these animals.
Botswana has experienced a big drought over the last decade. Thirsty and hungry, elephants have been roaming through villages more than ever. And so local people pleaded to lift the hunting ban. As a result, during the 2018 election, one candidate promised to listen and then was elected president. when you hear the next clip of a protester in the U.S., you might be able to guess what the new president did upon entering office.
President Masisi, how can you say you care about wildlife when you lifted the ban on killing elephants?
Here's the scene. It's a ballroom in Las Vegas. Glowing squares of pink and purple frame the stage. President Masisi stands patiently, hands resting on a glass podium. And there in the audience, a protester screams at the stage.
By lifting the ban, you're condoning the killing and murder by locals and foreign trophy hunters on one of the continent's most targeted animals. Not only that, but it's ethically wrong. It's inhumane, especially where there are proven common sense means in managing the human elephant conflict, which wouldn't cause harm to the elephant.
When Mokgweetsi Masisi was elected to govern Botswana, he lifted the hunting ban. And as you can tell, this did not go over well with international audiences.
This is not the answer. You have blood on your hands.
Wait, I wish you could sit down so I could talk to her. So the gentleman escorting out, if you could kindly just convince her to listen, so you have the, you know, bombs that go off here, and you sometimes have guns in the hands of people who should not have them, and you have landmines. And so what did the elephants do? They migrated. We have a lot of refugees.
Masisi is talking about Angola, which is a mere 60 kilometers north of Botswana. All around these elephants was war, and the war still lingers in the landmines beneath their feet, in the deserted tanks by the road. If the elephants in Angola move just a little bit south to Botswana, no more explosions or gunshots.
And you know what it means for our people, many of whom are subsistence farmers, poor village folk, who have never fought a war in their lives, who are loyal, law-abiding citizens.
It means that many of the local people of Botswana don't want to carry the environmental and financial burden of all the region's elephants anymore. So they started asking, wouldn't it be simple enough to just move elephants back into Angola?
The biggest problem for elephants moving into Angola are landmines. Like I said, they have a sense of smell stronger than a bloodhound, so they can smell landmine fields, they can avoid them once they know what they are. But to learn that, they have to go through a traumatic event with one of their family members. The Angolan government have made an incredible gesture and investment of $60 million to the Halo Trust to clear all landmines as far as they can in southeast Angola. That's not going to happen in a year, it's going to happen in 5 or 10 years. So by 2030, I would say Angola will be a lot more ready to accept tens of thousands of elephants. The roads will be built, technology would have advanced so we can transport them more safely. It's just not the right time now.
One of Steve's biggest concerns is that by introducing more of Botswana's elephant population into Angola, it could cause problems for the resident ghost elephants and local communities like Chinjanga.
The risk for human-wildlife conflict, very high, because you don't want an elephant that's stressed out. And that'll happen if you just parachute this poor thing into the upper catchments of the Okavango. It's going to go straight to the first village and try and eat those crops because it'll have no other option. It won't know where to find specialized food items that you do find up there.
And for many of you who might know of the Okavango Delta.
This is Botswana's President Masisi again.
It originates in Angola, in the highlands of Angola. And thankfully, this government of Angola has recently gazetted a whooping 9 million hectares of land to form part of the Trans-Frontier Parks.
The 9 million hectares of land he mentions is nearly the size of Portugal. It also includes the region Steve has been permitted to manage for the NGOWP. There is pressure from all around to move elephants from Botswana to Angola. This pressure is coming from local people, President Masisi, international donors, and not to mention the elephants themselves, who have outgrown the resources Botswana can offer them. Proposals involving helicopters, trucks, and conveyor belts are being passed around a number of international organizations. Steve's clock to find the ghost elephants, their habits, migratory patterns, and population size is running out. But Steve says wait.
First, we need to understand the survivors, the ghost elephants.
So, Steve, how did you arrange to have this helicopter?
The helicopter is also going to be flying circuits to the south of us, looking for the ghost elephants of Musima, this elephant population that is very cryptic and poorly known. And we're going to start this year to understand their movements, their behavior, and in the coming years, find ways of protecting them.
And they are savanna elephants?
These are savanna elephants.
I'm in the car with Kat and Steve. We're driving around Chinjanga, and clouds are piling on top of each other in the distance. It will be raining here momentarily. When it pours, the roads become like rivers. The sand resets itself, and all footprints and traces of elephants are washed away. This is one of the reasons why the villagers' stories are essential.
Apparently this landscape is a contact point for forest and savanna. This community here have reported 10 years ago having seen forest elephants come down. These are typically elephants that you find in the Congo, in the northern part of Angola. So it's a very interesting elephant population. They have had a really tough time of it in the last few decades, but now hopefully have opportunity to come back. It's our job to create safe space for elephants anywhere we can in Africa, and this is a big opportunity for that.
So there's something important to know about elephants. It isn't an elephant's nature to knock things down. They pull at branches, rip up tree roots, peel off bark. This is how they find food. If their foraging space is small, they are destroyers and will totally wreck a forest. But if the space is big, their damage can actually make a forest grow.
You'd be standing around here for a couple hours, crushing everything down and feeding randomly on all these trees. You can see they're all torn apart. So he's opening up a clearing here. And as a steward, he's left this one. He's going to let it grow up. They're choosing and managing this landscape. It's such an important function. And without them, the balance that we speak about is lost.
If Angola can first be made safe for elephants, with anti-poaching policies and training with local communities, Steve thinks elephants will return on their own. No conveyor belts or helicopters required. Elephants like to swim, like, really like to swim. They can swim 50 kilometers or 30 miles at a time. They move through river systems, and Steve is working to connect and protect them all.
The vision was to join the sources with the delta, the beginning with the end, source to sand, creating a 1,500-kilometer corridor, several hundred miles across, spanning that basin across its entirety. Now, if we do not protect the sources, the Lesima landscape up at the top has no resilience, and neither does the Okavango Delta. Both systems have become incredibly threatened. Elephants as a species really become threatened. So the wildlife corridor is a way of creating safe space for elephants to expand into. And obviously elephants are ambassadors for the other animals that they live with. They're the big engineers of the forests, planting the trees and breaking them down. And so elephants move up, lions, roan antelopes, everything else is going to benefit.
Governments, conservation organizations, and local communities have already created a transfrontier area to allow for elephant migrations across the borders of Angola, Botswana, and three surrounding countries. What Steve wants to safeguard are the waterways running between each of the parks. If he's successful, it will be the largest transfrontier wildlife corridor in the world, kind of like an elephant superhighway.
They will typically follow the rivers. You've got to find out seasonally when they would encounter ghost elephants. If you're introducing them to that population, the ghost elephants aren't going to attack them. No one's going to hurt each other. They're going to follow each other and learn from each other. We need to retain that cultural knowledge that is taught from mother to daughter to son in the ghost elephant population. And we need to protect that like it is the most important thing. It is the secret to having elephants up there. And secrets are learnt over many, many generations.
Way back at the beginning, when I tried to explain what this podcast was going to be about to other people, I would watch their eyes glaze over until we got to the elephants. It wasn't the indigenous folklore, nor the lofty mission to protect a critical water system. It was the elephants, and I'm not totally proud of it now, but it was how Steve hooked me. And I remember at the time thinking to myself, these ghost elephants are surely the story. But my relationship with it all has changed in my many months of being in the field, and I left with this deep desire to help the NGOWP tell a different narrative. What started with elephants came to be very, very focused on the humans.
The proudest moment from that expedition was the elephants.
You may remember Ajani from the documentary Into the Okavango in episode one of this podcast.
The moment that we finally realized that there were Angolan elephants was a point of shift in between the Angolan consciousness and my self-consciousness. We spent months hearing about the elephants, but we never saw one. And the point that at the border, we finally saw the elephants, it was that expectation of hope that it is possible, that we actually have everything to be successful in terms of conservation, in terms of biodiversity, that we still have it all. I think that was the proudest moment as an Angolan. It was a very difficult feeling to describe.
Elephants are one of the biggest draws to the Okavango region, and it makes sense. Sometimes they're standing by the road and their ears are flapping in the heat. Other times they're traveling in herds, carving pathways through the delta's waters. Magnificent, beguiling, almost human-like in their familiar relationships to one another. It's hard for me to look at their face and not somehow also see myself, or the face of someone I love. But this infatuation we have with them, it's like a fictitious romance. When you see them, you become mesmerized by them. Maybe you want to conquer them, like a hunter, or maybe you want to protect them, like so many of us do. But it's almost as if, once in this trance, we forget the bigger macrocosm that they are part of, the very thing that science teaches us, that we are part of a holistic system we too often overlook. And instead, we focus on the one species that intrigues us. Sometimes it's elephants, and sometimes it's humans. But if being an Angolan has taught me anything, it is that to truly save either, we must think about them both. Sivai, Jehovah! Sivai, Jehovah! Sivai, Jehovah! Hey, Jehovah! Next time on Guardians of the River, we head to Tempwe to hear from our local communities on what protecting this region means to them and how they are handling outsiders coming into their villages for the first time since the Civil War. You're listening to Guardians of the River, a podcast about the quest to safeguard one of the world's most remote and wild lands. I'm your host, Kerlin Costa. The story was written and recorded by Kat Jaffe and House of Pod, in partnership with the National Geographic Okavango Wilderness Project. This podcast is funded through a National Geographic Storytelling Grant and the Wild Bird Trust. If you're new to podcasts, you can find a guide on how to listen to this show and support the project at wildbirdtrust.com. You can also find this podcast on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to great audio. Our fact-checker is Amy Machado. Our producer is Juliette Luini. Our illustrator is Fernando Hugo Fernandes. Our audio editor and sound designer is Jason Patton. Our Angolan producer is myself, Kerlin Costa. We had story editing help from Rebecca Mendoza-Nunziato, and our composer is Victor Gama.
I read part of a poem by the late writer Jean Valentin and a segment about the Clown Cemetery from the Chicago Tribune. Links to these pieces, as well as more resources, are available in our show notes.
A big thank you to Geração 80 in Luanda. And thank you always to Dr. Steve Boyce and John Hilton of the Wild Bird Trust, who have sponsored and supported this production. And for me, Carolyn Costa, and the team, Moyo Eno.